House Committee on Labor, Monday, April 2nd. Hearing on House Bill 2726 relating to workers' compensation, and Senate Bill 371 relating to refund of an overpayment of workers.
House Labor Committee, come to order. Clerk will take note of those present. We do not have a quorum, so we will go into a subcommittee for the purpose of taking testimony on House Bill 2726. Representative Lombard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kip Lombard, State Representative, District 52. I will be very brief in my comments because there are a number of people I know wanting to testify on this matter that are much better qualified than I to talk about the particulars. Suffice it to say that I've had a number of constituents contact me over the interim with regard to the current status of independent truckers, those who own and maintain their own tractors and often their own trailers also, and the matter of whether or not, the matter that they are required to carry or have carried on them workers' compensation. As this committee well knows, this last session, the legislature in 1977 did create a specific exemption for individual owner-operators who transported logs, poles, and pilings. Now, House Bill 2726, in its present original form, would extend that exemption also to haulers of rock, gravel, sand, dirt, or asphalt concrete. I have presented to committee staff a very simple hand-engrossed proposed amendment, which would carry the proposal and the concept of this bill even further to exempt all independent owner-operators operators of motor vehicles for hire. I simply leave the proposed amendment with you, and I know some people that who are here to testify on this will be testifying to my amendment, so they'll be testifying beyond the scope of just the extension of the bill to haulers of rock and gravel and so forth. So with that, I'll simply leave these items with the committee, and as I say, I prefer to let others more knowledgeable about this than I am really speak to the problem and to what they're hoping to accomplish. I might add parenthetically that there is a related problem dealing with coverage requirements for unemployment compensation, and arising particularly out of the recent Supreme Court decisions in the case of Republic Development Company versus Employment Division, Byrne Trucking versus Employment Division, and Mitchell Brothers Trucking, Mitchell Brothers Truck Lines versus Employment Division. And looking over the bill that is before you, I do not believe that the relating clause is broad enough to also make a proposal that we have here. So I would it would be my hope that in the very near future that I can present to the committee for possible introduction as a committee bill a proposal also that would address this same area as it relates to unemployment compensation. Representative Rogers.
Your estimation 2173, my sorry to do that.
2173? Okay.
Seems that we've heard that a couple of times.
All right. Sounds familiar. Ring the bell.
Kip, someone else will talk to us about all the various categories of motor vehicles for hire.
I hope they will address that. Oh. Yeah. I know the people that, certain people I know will be speaking specifically to their own categories that they would like to have covered. And of course, if the committee feels that the category is too broad and ought to be refined, of course, I think that's the prerogative of the committee. But I think the committee will get a pretty good idea of the reach of the proposed amendments through the testimony of the witnesses.
Okay.
Okay, Chip, just one question. I'm sure that you've analyzed it pretty well, but the impact that something like this has on the system overall, that the more we exempt, of course, the less that are paying in. And also, now this doesn't say that they may be exempted out, it says that they will be.
Right.
So, what about those folks that are out there that are working in this in some of these jobs who later become injured? What happens to them?
Well, of course, if they are not covered by the system, the fact of the matter is the system does not cover them. And they're the ones who are asking for the exemption in this case.
Well, is it 100% down the line, I guess is my question. And I know we hear from a lot of people that...
Well, I don't think any of us would be so foolish as to try to represent that there is 100% feeling one way or the other. I would suggest this, that if there are a number of people out there who desire coverage, who want coverage, that they could obtain such coverage, they also have the option, of course, of obtaining both disability coverage and health and accident coverage independently. So I think the options are available in the current market. This just takes it out of the mandatory coverage category. I agree that there may be a significant impact, perhaps from the premium standpoint. I would suggest the committee also take a look at the loss experience in this area. For all I know, and I honestly don't know, you might find Safe and other companies making a saving here.
Sure. Another question? Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Bob Knight.
Chairman and members of the committee, for your record, my name is Robert Knight. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association, and in that capacity, I'm representing several hundred for-hire motor carriers during this session of the legislature. And we are here today, the association is here today to support the amendment presented by Representative Lombard. And even though the proposed amendment will only affect a small number of the OTA membership, we would like your record and the proceedings going on House Bill 2726 to show that it has the full support of the membership. The amendment being suggested by Representative Lombard would exempt all owner-operators. Well, that's kind of a generic term we use in the industry. In the printed bill, I believe you're using the term a person who engages in transportation for hire and who both furnishes and maintains the vehicle. Owner-operators, some who provide their own insurance, others that operate in interstate commerce, and as a result may or may not be subject to injury within the state of Oregon have caused quite a bit of extra bookkeeping and problems to companies who are domiciled in Oregon. But to more fully explain the ramifications of this bill and how it would affect the operator of general commodities, we have with us today one or two witnesses who can give you a full background on it. I would like to respond to your question, Mr. Chairman, that there is a provision in the statutes today under ORS 656128 where these persons who wish to be covered could as sole proprietors. Certainly, I would respond to any questions, Mr. Chairman, or members of the committee, but I would hope that speaking to the amendment that Mr. Hurlman of West Coast could come up here and explain to you why that company is in dire need of this and then the others following him. We do support the amendment.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rogers.
Bob, we've dealt with this before, a little more explicit, and my question that came up is the fact that the if you can opt an in or out, there's some adverse selection involved in that, because someone with a problem as an owner-operator may option in, or someone without a problem can get other insurance without a doubt. Would your association have any objection to changing the law so there could be no optioning in or out, but if they're out, they're out as a group?
Representative Rogers, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rogers, if that was the desire of the committee, I'm sure that we would accept it. We do believe that that provision is there in 656128 for that particular person if he wished to opt in without placing it as an option made from shall to may or something in Representative Lombard's bill amendment. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Bob. Is it Holman? Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Holman?
Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Hurleman. I have with me his Executive Vice President of the West Coast Truck Lines, Dean Barton. As it is currently written, ORS 656027, paragraph 11, exempts from ORS 656001 to 656794 a person who engages in transportation by motor vehicle of logs, poles, and piling, and who both furnishes and maintains the vehicle used in such transportation. This paragraph was added to ORS 656-27 by the 1977 Legislative Assembly, and rightfully so, we feel, since someone who engages in the transportation of heavy commodities and provides the vehicle which is maintained at their own expense is truly engaged in a business in their own right. Such a person has significant capital at risk in the form of the vehicle, and must incur material operating expenses to maintain the equipment. Now, through House Bill 2726, the Committee on Labor, at the request of the Associated General Contractors, is seeking to rectify an inequity in that those persons who engage in the transportation of rocks, gravel, sand, dirt, and asphaltic concrete, and who also furnish and maintain their vehicles, were overlooked by the 1977 Legislative Assembly. We maintain that there is no significant difference between someone who furnishes and maintains a vehicle to haul logs and someone who does the same to haul rocks or gravel. West Coast Truck Lines has many driver lessors, otherwise known as owner-operators, under contract who haul several kinds of heavy commodities in interstate commerce. These owner-operators are providing and maintaining the vehicle, and they are also paying all other significant operating expenses. Many of these owner-operators are Oregon residents, and others are residents of the other West Coast states. Should someone who lives in Oregon and furnishes and maintains a vehicle to transport lumber grown in Milton, Oregon, to California be subject to ORS 656, while someone who hauled the logs for the lumber or the gravel for the road is not? They're all in the business of transporting property. We also ask, could someone who hauls another load of lumber from Oregon to California, but who contracts to a transportation company based in California, be exempt from ORS 656, while the contractor leased to an Oregon-based company is held subject to the statute? We submit to the committee that the only fair action to take in revising paragraph 11 of ORS 656-27 is to strike the language of logs, poles, and piling. Then the statute will affect all parties who furnish and maintain a motor vehicle for transportation equally. We respectfully request that the committee amend House Bill 2726 or substitute another bill striking such language so that ORS 656-27-11 will ultimately read, a person who engages in transportation for hire, I didn't inject that in, by motor vehicle and who both furnishes and maintains the vehicle used in such transportation. West Coast Truck Lines is disadvantaged in the conduct of its business, as are other Oregon-based transportation companies, because we must compete to attract owner-operators with companies based in states where the independent contractor status of the owner-operator exempts the owner-operator from mandatorily having to pay for workers' compensation insurance. The owner-operators who contract to West Coast Truck Lines are required to pay a minimum of $2,327.04 per year for workers' compensation insurance. If they contract to a motor freight carrier based in another state, they will not have to pay this cost. This seriously hampers our efforts to attract owner-operators to enter into contracts with West Coast Truck Lines. Our company is a growing firm that uses owner-operators to supplement our fleet of 137 trucks and tractors. As of February 28, 1979, we had an active contract with 113 owner-operators, most of whom are Oregon residents. During February 1979, West Coast Truck Lines employed 231 Oregon residents. Our corporate goals include public responsibility and growth. By sharing the risk with us, owner-operators are helping us to grow faster than we could otherwise. As our base grows, we add assets and employees in Oregon, and thereby enhance the economy of the state. ORS 656-27 currently creates an inequity against those owner-operators who contract to Oregon-based motor freight carriers and places Oregon-based motor carriers at a competitive disadvantage with carriers based in neighboring states. This committee has the opportunity to repair a discriminatory situation that works a handicap on many Oregon citizens and upon a significant segment of the transportation industry. We petition you to correct ORS 656-27-11 to treat all such owner-operators alike. Thank you.
Representative Johnson. Presently, do you charge that to the owner-operator as a part of the cost of doing business, or is that a part of your percentage that you withhold?
Well, these people have their own individual policies, and they have personal elections filed.
Explain that.
They have an individual policy. The owner-operators have their own policy with any insurance company of their choice, one licensed to ride in the state of Oregon, and they have gone as far as to
So you don't participate in it at all.
Pardon me?
You don't participate at all in it, then. You don't write, the insurance is not written through you.
Oh, no.
Okay. Then the rates aren't going to go down because we exempt them.
No, they don't have anything to do with our modifier or anything, no.
Your percentage of take from the trucker isn't going to be reduced because of this thing.
That's correct. This will not affect us. It will affect all the owner-operators contracting to us. The owner-operators that come on with us, their feeling is, why do we have to pay workers' compensation? They do not want to be involved in it.
But before they can operate with you, they have to assure a valid policy.
That's correct.
Well, it is going to make a difference because if the owner-operator doesn't have as much overhead, he isn't going to charge you as much. So you're going to negotiate a different kind of contract with him, aren't you? If you can reduce his expense, and certainly you're going to reduce his expense, he doesn't have to carry the coverage.
We are currently paying our owner-operators on a percentage of the gross of the haul, and the haul is that gross is determined by a tariff bill. So there's a flat rate that the owner-operator gets on a haul basis. Each load is paid on a different basis. There's a different rate for each load. If a load of lumber goes from Salem to Hayward, it would get a certain dollar per hundredweight on the truck, and if it was to go another 10 miles further, it would get more, and if it was to haul less weight, it would get less for the load. The owner-operator, what I was trying to convey, I guess, to the owner-operator, has his own policy. We do not withhold these monies as part of our overall premium. He has a policy of his own outside of West Coast Truck Line. And many of the owner-operators, when they come on with us, have sufficient insurance in other areas to cover themselves for any injuries or illnesses or disabilities. And this is an extra cost to them.
I'd like to interject something here. If I understand you right, you
indicated that this would enable us to lower the amount that we pay to the owner-operator.
The impression I got from what the statement was that you made is that you're non-competitive with people coming from the other end of the hall because they don't have to pay the same price that the people up here do. Is that not correct?
Oh.
That's what it said, yeah.
Well, and I
you're going to reduce their cost because they're not going to, somebody's not going to pay whatever the rate times the payroll is.
The way we're not competitive is in attracting these other owner-operators, the out-of-state owner-operators, or even the in-state owner-operators, to an Oregon-based firm. Should they go to another one, they don't have to pay that extra premium.
Yeah.
If they were to contract to an out-of-state-based firm, they would not have to pay workers' compensation.
We compete with other trucking firms like ourselves, many of which are based in California, for example, for these owner-operators. And we're in a competition with them to attract them to our firms because we do use them to help us grow, as you can see. But we also, at West Coast Truck Lines, have a lot of company trucks. That we're company drivers that we do pay the workers' compensation on. So we, like all other trucking companies, need the owner-operators to help us also grow. This is quite the way the industry is growing these days. A man will go out and buy a truck and then elect to put it on with an interstate carrier. And it does hamper us in competition about companies and attracting them. Because this is just another in excess of a $2,000 cost that these men are looking at.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. You have company-owned trucks, employees, drivers that drive those company-owned trucks, correct? How many do you have? What?
I think I have a figure here, but...
We have 137 of our own power units.
Okay. And then you have lease operators?
Currently,
113. Are there any plans to go more to the owner-operator or lease-operator?
I might add, since this was written, we've added 25 new company trucks.
Company trucks?
Yes.
Okay, so are you intending to go one way or the other?
No, we just, we don't really intend to go one way or another. We just go with whichever way helps us to grow at the time. Anymore, when you order a company truck, and they do have to be quite specialized, you're looking at 9 months to a year before you can put these trucks on. And right now, if we hit a fast growth stage, the objective is to try to respond to the market. The only way you can respond to the market is by obtaining trucks as rapidly as possible. And we do that by trying to attract owner-operators, men who already have these trucks somewhere, running somewhere to come to work for
us. Okay, so there's quite a pool out there, right, that you can draw from?
Correct.
Representative Rogers.
You talked about the owner-operator, and I think I understand now why you have the mix, is because you can expand for immediate needs more quickly with the owner-operator.
Why we have a mix of company trucks and our operators. Mm-hmm. Another reason we have this mix is because within the state of Oregon, we have Oregon Intrastate Operating Authority, and the state of Oregon will not allow us to run owner-operators within the state of Oregon on Oregon Intrastate Commerce.
I see. So you must use your own tractors and equipment for intrastate.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, let me get back to the bill at hand. You've given all these reasons for asking for this, but I'm a little bit confused. Now, I dealt with the log truck thing for a two session, and that's two last session. But there was a specific case there where the workers' comp department state was charging these folks that they had to have workers' comp cover because of some court decision. Now, are you in that same category, or can one of these owner-operators have a private coverage for a hospitalization coverage, either whether he wants to or not?
He may have the private coverage, however...
You're talking about private coverage, you're talking about Blue Cross or...
Yes, he may have that in addition, however... Under the statutes as they presently read, the basis for determining an employer, somebody is going to be the employer on that man, the way it reads right now. Whether it's the individual or the company he's leased to, somebody will be the employer. And ultimately, he will have to have this on-the-job injury covered by a workers' compensation carrier somewhere.
Something's not. I presume we're going to hear from workers. Department.
Yeah.
Shortly, I'll hold those questions.
I did have another question too.
You indicated that you can't operate owner-operators use owner-operators interstate. Is that because your rights don't aren't for
no.
allow you to, or is there
no? We have unrestricted intrastate operating authorities. We cannot use them within the state of Oregon because the Oregon Public Utility Commission states that anybody who is not an employee of the company holding the authority may not participate in the transportation of intrastate commerce. These men are not our employees, and therefore are under the rules and regulations
rule. What do you charge your operators for running in the using your permit?
We charge them on a percentage. This is just strictly interstate movements. So it's a percentage, and it will vary to a certain degree upon the commodity that they haul and whether they have their own trailer or not. But we charge them a basic 65%, which is the industry standard throughout the nation, you might say. It's most companies work from a 65% basis. With a sort of sliding scale based upon commodities, and of course the owner operators pay more if he pulls his own trailer.
Excuse me, I believe Dean said we charge them. We charge them 35% and reimburse them 65%.
Yeah, that's right. We charge them 35%. They get 65%.
I see. And what do you provide the fuel in that, or not? Do they have to fight all the operational costs?
No, they make all their own operational costs.
So for the privilege of using your permit, it costs them 35%.
That's right.
That is an issue that's going on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The interstate hauling, can't you trip lease to an independent?
Not intrastate.
You can't trip lease on an interstate. Interesting. Hmm. Okay. I thought that at least you used to be able to do it. And didn't you one time where you could use your authority if you on a trip lease basis?
The last I knew, it's been some time since I got involved in talking to PUC about this, but no, you can't. The PUC won't recognize trip leasing. The interstate.
ICC.
You can. The ICC does. We can trip lease a truck from California to Oregon. You cannot trip lease a truck from Eugene to Portland on intrastate commerce.
Well, I've been out of the trucking business for about 15, 20 years. Okay, any other questions?
One more question, Mr. Chairman. For an owner operator who comes in with just a tractor, what kind of an investment does he have? Let's assume that it's a new unit.
Oh, these days about $45,000.
Okay, and if he has his own trailer?
Oh, add another $12,000.
Representative Rogers, that $45,000 would be a low figure and it would be a figure more for a two-axle tractor. I believe for a three-axle tractor, more like between $55,000 and $60,000 at today's prices would be more current.
Okay.
Which is mostly what we use.
You didn't say yours is not as high price as the log truck.
Mm-hmm.
To pay off.
We just purchased some two-axle tractors, and I think that's probably where Dean's figure came from.
The 5560 for two-axle.
Of course, some of them, it all depends on what kind of equipment they get.
Mr. Kalinowski. I'm not sure if it's Jack or Jim.
No,
I don't
know. Oh, it's
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have a copy of my testimony. I just noticed that it's dated May 2. I hope you'll excuse that typographical error, April 2. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Kalinowski. I represent the Associated General Contractors. We favor passage of House Bill 2726. The need for this legislation has been brought about by two factors. First, a letter opinion from the Attorney General to State Representative Bill Markham, dated June 7, 1978. Representative Markham asked if one who owns and operates heavy equipment of a nature commonly operated for hire to the general public is a, quote, subject worker, end quote, under Oregon's workers' compensation law. The Attorney General answered that it depends. An owner-operator may be deemed to be a subject worker and an independent contractor in succeeding employment, each instance being based upon the facts of a particular situation. Secondly, at least one carrier of workers' compensation insurance is making independent decisions regarding this issue and demanding payment of premiums by those with whom the owner-operators have contracted, maintaining in these instances that owner-operators of trucks are, for all intents and purposes, employees of the person with whom the owner-operator is contracted. One carrier is now demanding about $22,000 from the owner of an operation that mines, crushes, and sells rock that is transported to customers in trucks that are owner-operated. While House Bill 2726 will not solve his and other similar existing problems, it would prevent such misunderstandings and disputes in the future. There are several persuasive arguments as to why owner-operators of dump trucks should be classified as independent contractors and exempt from mandatory workers' compensation insurance coverage. One, they determine for themselves whether or not they wish to haul loads and what days and times of day they wish to do so. Two, their fee for their service is negotiated. Three, they are free to drive for any of the many companies that may need their services. Four, they own their own trucks and are individually responsible for all maintenance, supplies, and repairs required for their vehicles. Five, each owner-operator has been certified as an independent contractor by the Public Utility Commissioner. Six, an owner-operator may haul loads for more than one customer on any given day, and these decisions are his and his alone to make. All of the above define the independent characteristics of owner-operators and seem to indicate that exemptions from mandatory coverage is warranted. However, the Attorney General states, if the work performed by the owner-operator in the instant situation is an essential part of the overall operation of the employer, and if the cost of injuries to the owner-operator could be most effectively distributed by the employer through the price charged to the consumer for the product, it is probable that the owner-operator would be considered a subject worker, not an independent contractor, for the purposes of the Workers' Compensation Act. That determination is in each case predicated upon the overall facts and conditions of the employment involved. It is grossly unfair to place the burden upon the person with whom the owner-operator contracts as to whether the conditions of their agreement will mean the independent contractor is in fact a subject worker. House Bill 2726 would tell both parties, as well as the carriers, that he is not a subject worker. This assembly has three options with regard to this issue: enact the measure as it is written, amend it to state that owner-operators are not exempt from mandatory coverage, or do nothing regarding the issue. Frankly, we don't care which action is taken as long as it is not the latter. We desperately need clarification. Should you decide to select the second option, the owner-operator will include the cost of insurance in his rates, and this may cause the rates for hauling to increase about 3 to 4% in our estimation, which will be passed on to the consumer. We respectfully request favorable consideration of House Bill 2726. You have a copy, Mr. Chairman, of the Attorney General's full letter opinion to Representative Martin.
That, are you telling us that in the, and you're speaking not to the amended bill, you're speaking to the original bill?
Yes, I understand the bill has not been amended yet.
Well, but it's proposed.
Yes.
Yeah. So you think that in the gravel and sand hauling operation, asphalt and all the other stuff that they're now running the same thing that the log truckers were into before? Or has this been an ongoing thing along with the log truckers?
Well, it hasn't been an ongoing thing since 1978. As a matter of fact, the bill that exempted from mandatory coverage owner-operators of log trucks, as it was originally introduced, included the wording that is proposed by this bill. We investigated and came to the conclusion through our legal counsel that those who haul dirt, rock, sand, gravel, asphalt, concrete were, as owner-operators, were exempt as independent contractors. Then along came the Republic case. One of the previous people testifying, I identified that case. Since the 1977 session of Jim Tiny Guy, that, I think, coupled with the Attorney General's letter opinion, has confused this issue to the point where it is virtually impossible for anybody to predetermine whether the agreement to engage an owner-operator for these purposes, it makes them a subject worker or not. The problem is, Representative Rogers, that it is looked at retrospectively.
So you are asking for that clarification, not the third alternative, which was exercised for a while, at least in the log truck. So you have not, you do not have a case at hand where someone is being assessed.
Oh, we have several. I cite one in my testimony. The $22,000 is computed as being the back premium.
Okay. Which, is this an independent carrier or is this Safe?
This happens to be Safe.
Is just Safe one that's trying to do this, or are the independent carriers also there?
I don't know. The only ones I know of are insured with Safe.
Okay. Because that seems to be the rub with the log truck. Welcome.
I really wish you hadn't asked me, Rep.
Yeah, see, some of these things. I was thinking that the sand and gravel were in before, and you asked it to be taken out. So. And so.
In 1977, yes.
Right. You must have did that.
We surely did. Had we been prophetic, we wouldn't have done that.
Mr. Kuchetsky, in your testimony you say the owner-operator will include the cost of insurance in his rate. So that is kind of I mean, that's not a guarantee that they would do that.
Oh, no, but anybody doing business in a any kind of logical sense will take into account all of this cost. That is, anybody except public agencies doing construction work.
That's a different committee, Mr. Shona.
Viable issue, however. I beg your pardon.
If I'm starting out in the business and I want to try to get an edge in competition, I might say, well, I'll start my insurance coverage at the first of the year. I'll go 6 months and hope that I don't, that nothing happens in terms of myself. It's one way to have a little price competition against other suckers is not to have insurance.
Well, if coverage is mandatory, they would include. I don't think anybody in their right mind would do that, Mike, in all honesty. Because ultimately, he's going to have to pay the premium anyway, you know, if his account is audited.
You support the proposed amendment?
I think the amendment includes everything that we were instantly concerned about. Yes, I see nothing wrong with the amendment.
One other, you didn't say you didn't care whether the bill passed or whether we passed the bill this way or said the opposite.
We prefer the bill be passed stating that they are exempt from mandatory coverage, but if the legislature feels that they should not be exempted, then that's fine too. That would be our second choice.
I thought I heard you say you didn't care,
but I said you have three options. Just please don't take the third one, which is do nothing.
Right.
But our number one priority is exempt them from mandatory coverage. Second priority is to say they are covered, which raises some mechanical problems. And the third is do nothing.
Would you check the tape better, Mike? If you did. Okay.
We always check the tape. That's the exact thing.
Thank you.
Okay. Just in line. Yeah.
Mr. Page? How about Mr. Stewart? Would you like to come up at the same time? Just burn trucking, that's right. Go ahead, Mr. Page.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lex Page. I represent Mitchell Brothers Truck Lines. I am an employee of Mitchell Brothers Truck Lines. And I appear here in support of House Bill 2726 as proposed to be amended, proposal having been read into the record by Representative Lombard. In addition, our operations, I might preface my remarks, our operations are very similar to those of West Coast Truck Lines. In fact, we like to consider them one of our major competitors within the state here. I'm sure they would look upon us as one of their major competitors. We utilize the services of independent contractor owner-operators extensively in our operations. We operate primarily in the 11 western states and in portions of Canada. As I said, our operations are very similar to West Coast. We are in competition not only with West Coast, but several other major interstate carriers for the services of independent contractors. Right at this moment, independent contractors are a very valuable commodity, and any truck lines which utilizes their services finds that in order to expand, you have to, in effect, offer them a better deal. As with West Coast, we find ourselves at a disadvantage operating in this state because, as Mr. Kalinowski pointed out, the confusion from the law as it exists in this state at the present time makes it impossible to predetermine whether or not an individual is going to be labeled as a subject employee, subject worker, or as an independent contractor. We are one of the parties in that trilogy of cases, Republic, Byrne, and Mitchell Brothers. This, of course, does place us at a superior disadvantage in that, in order to, in effect, cover our tails, we require as a condition of contracting that the independent contractor maintain a workman's compensation policy on file with us. As with West Coast, we do not participate in the writing or negotiations of it, only that he shows us that he is covered before he can contract with us. Inasmuch as the costs in this state run approximately $200 a month per individual at this time, many of these individuals who own their own equipment choose to go to a carrier who is not domiciled in the state of Oregon rather than to sign on with Mitchell Brothers Truck Lines or West Coast or Byrne. There are several major carriers out of the Midwest that succeed in attracting a lot of these individuals, taking expansion growth away from Oregon-based businesses.
Clarification at this point. Now, you require that they show you a certificate for a workers' comp specifically, not just a health and accident policy.
Workers' compensation, that's correct.
Okay, well, I understood West Coast to say that they don't require workers' comp. Okay. The same thing. So you make it. The specific requirement.
That is correct. That is correct. Workman's compensation, either, I think in this state at least, the most frequent carriers are SAFE and EBI.
Okay. When did you begin requiring that specific showing?
That has been a condition of contracting with us ever since we started utilizing the services of independent contractors, and that would have been in 1975 or 6. Or I believe. Mm-hmm. We came off strike.
Okay, so you've been retiring since 1974.
That's correct.
Okay, why are we just now hearing about it?
To be quite frank, this is the first opportunity for us to present it. We have recently undergone a change of ownership and management, and as a result, we are changing a lot of our thinking on a lot of regards. Plus, as I stated previously, the independent contractor is getting to be a rather rare breed of cat, and in order to be competitive, this $200 a month is killing us a lot of times.
Can someone who owns his own factory that lives in Oregon contract with a company from Kansas, fall under their permit, and operate under Kansas rules?
Certainly, and they very frequently do. Not necessarily Kansas, anywhere in 48
states. Well, just somewhere in the Midwest.
That's correct. Most of the major carriers of our type of motor carrier are domiciled in right-to-work states. Texas, Oklahoma, Minnesota, Midwestern states such as that. And, well, quite frankly, they just don't impose a lot of the restrictions that Oregon does. In addition, because Oregon has specific statutory tests which preempt the federal case law and federal common law, we find ourselves as a motor carrier doing business in this state in effect being whipsawed between the federal rules, the federal tests on one hand, and the state tests on the other. As a kind of quick and dirty rule, basically what it amounts to is the amount of control exerted by the motor carrier over the individual who owns the equipment. This determines whether or not that individual is going to be determined to be an employee or an independent contractor. We have had no problems whatsoever with the federal government to this point. However, as a result of the confusion in the law in this state, and the law requiring, or possibly being interpreted to require more control than the federal government would require, we're finding ourselves being drawn into a position that we would not be able to control the independent contractor as you would an employee. But by the same token, because he owns his own equipment, He can take it to go any place he wants, any time he wants. Breaking contract with, not breaking, but voiding the contract with us, going somewhere else, and us having no recourse, losing business, losing growth. I guess, in effect, what we would be asking would be that the state law be brought more into conformity with federal law, that there be more of a uniform test.
Could you elaborate a bit on that? I guess I don't understand. You're saying that the tests are different for federal and state. Is that what you're saying, in essence?
That is correct, yes. Under state law...
How do they differ, if you can delineate that difference?
Well, I don't have the text of the state law in front of me. I believe that we've heard previous testimony that's contained in, and if I'm wrong, I'd like to stand corrected, but I think it's ORS 656.128.
That's the state, okay.
I believe that's correct. That defines subject worker, okay, in this state. Okay.
Fine.
Under the federal case law and common law, it pretty much boils down to the degree of control exerted by
federal law is basically common law.
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct for purposes of Internal Revenue Service regulations, revenue rulings, Social Security, federal unemployment compensation.
But you're saying that under the federal system, you could operate those people, and they would not be considered employees.
That is correct.
And yet, and that applies even when you control where they go to get their loads, when they deliver them, and
I would like
other things as independent operators.
I would like
me to operate with these people.
Okay, I'd like to speak to that for just a moment, if I might. We do not control past requirements placed upon us by the shipping public. Where they go to pick up their loads, what time to deliver, the routes they take, the amount of time it takes them to deliver, where they take their rest stops, anything of that nature. A shipper will call us requesting that a load be picked up on the 6th of April, for example. We will pass that information along to the independent contractor. We will pass on to him that the shipper has requested the load be picked up on the 6th of April. It's to be picked up in Portland, Oregon, destined for Los Angeles, California. The shipper requests that load be delivered on the 13th, no later than the 13th. He does not demand that of us. We do not demand that. We do not demand that.
Let's just go from there, though. What happens to the poor driver who doesn't do what your dispatcher asks? So seriously, now.
You mean if
suppose he
says he rejects the load,
suppose he arrives on the 8th. I can't imagine that you people don't control that well enough to either send somebody else, which is their control. Or
do you mean
to ensure that the customer is taken care of?
We take no disciplinary action against the independent contractor.
You don't?
No, sir. We may never hear from that shipper again, and we'd very much regret that. But he is a businessman that has been sent, he knows his...
is that what you tell your dispatcher to? I mean, you're in the front office, but is that what you tell
your dispatcher? The dispatcher takes no disciplinary action against the leader. If he doesn't feel he can make that requested pickup date, he has the option of rejecting the load completely, and no disciplinary action is taking place on that basis.
Thank you,
I'd like to go ahead, officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator. My name is Dave Stewart. I'm with Byrne Trucking in Medford. Byrne Trucking definitely would like to see the passage of this amendment to 2726, House Bill 2726. Byrne is primarily an owner-operator company. We are the smaller, probably, of the three represented here in the room today. Byrne operates two company trucks, and the remainder of our fleet is comprised of owner-operated equipment. In retrospect to some of the problems that are looking at us now and in the future, with respect to insurance, other areas, as iterated earlier, as a competitive situation for being able to secure owner-operators in Oregon, we are disadvantaged by states such as Washington and California because of the policies relative to those states. Many times, owner-operators or people who own their own equipment and maintain that equipment come to our company with the idea that they would like to be contracted to us on a permanent lease basis. A permanent lease is basically is that which is closed in. There's no termination date, except we do have an out on both parties on certain written notice and so forth. The individuals can terminate that lease at any time. We do have some instant termination on both sides of the thing. As opposed to Metro Brothers truck lines, where we would receive a load, for instance, for dispatch, or a number of loads for dispatch, we offer the load to the owner-operators. If the owner-operator doesn't feel that he can make, or she can make, because we have both men and women as owner-operators in our fleet, if that owner-operator cannot make a commitment on the with regards to the customer's needs, the communication back and forth is such that we are in a position to offer that to another owner-operator. Hence, if we can't cover it at all with any of our owner-operators, then we would go to a triple situation. So we're covered in either way. The financial impact of this thing to Byrne Trucking is nil as far as it goes regarding the insurance itself. The financial impact to the owner-operators is substantial. Considering the amount of money that is invested in a piece of equipment, considering the inverse side of the business, considering that each independent owner-operator has to take care of his or her own expenses going in and coming out, this is a burden. And this is a factor which we have faced from time to time in discussions in our safety meetings and general company meetings with our owner-operators. We would like to see passage of this bill because I think in the outcome it will have a certain amount of relief on the general public in a sense that if you can reduce operating costs, and I'm not talking about us cutting the owner-operator's division of revenue. We pay probably one of the highest divisions of revenue to the owner-operator with a basic settlement of 75% of the gross going to the owner-operator, 25% to Byrne to take care of the overhead. We have bonus programs involved that could increase their operating capital to 80% for their settlement. Depending, for instance, an example is when they reach a certain level in a month of so much dollar revenue to them, we increase their revenue actually by 5% more, which brings them into an 80 percentile range. But consequently, they're not quite as tight or under the gun, probably, as some other ones. However, on the other side of the fence, we do normally require that they bring their own trailer aboard. We have purchased some traders, about 10 traders recently, for the purpose of being able to bring owner-operators aboard. However, the way we're doing this is not penalizing on the basis of the reduction in the amount to them, but rather leasing the trailer at exactly what our capital in capital cost is on that trailer. The reason to generate more trucks. We're a growing company. We've got a situation where we could grow more. Our freight imbalances are being corrected daily. And we find that we would rather have a permanent owner-operator fleet than a trip lease fleet, because this really benefits the people here more than it does perhaps a California-based or a Washington-based carrier who's looking for a way home. If there can be a cost factor cut somewhere along the line, I'm sure that the thing ultimately is handed down to the general public at some point. It might not be the entire $200 in a month period of time, but I do believe it will retrospectively look over
our entire operation. Even though the owner-operator pays, the actual cost saving is passed along and every little bit helps.
I do have a question of you, Mr. Bates. Are you basically, you said you're basically a owner-operator leases, or are you the owner on truck, basically?
We have our own equipment, but we also, the preponderance of our fleet is owner-operator.
Which is like percentage-wise. The other company had their figures, you know, offhand,
we have approximately 200 owner-operators, independent contractors. We have 20 company-owned trucks.
Mr. Good, how many trucks do you have under this lease at a typical time?
As of 9 o'clock this morning, 73.
It could be different this afternoon.
This afternoon it could be.
Now, do you follow the same policy that the other two companies, you require the showing of a workers' comp policy?
That is correct. Excepting recently we modified that to the point where in order to be in complete compliance with the requirements of Oregon's particular situation, we have the comp carrier with an all-face endorsement. And the reason is too often an owner-operator would come in who had been, say, a CalTIA, California carrier as an example, will come in and have a specific policy with a California, with the state of California State Compensation Fund. Okay, they do not grant an all-state endorsement. So we have to require that they have a company or a policy that is an all-state endorsement that covers us in any state that we operate. So what we have done is we've secured the compensation, workman's compensation for them with the with an Oregon-based carrier through our agents, and the rates are the same anyway. But in order to get that all-state endorsement, so that if they're injured in another state, they are covered in another state.
But now, you do that only for the owner, the long-term owner-operator. You don't do it on the trip lease.
On the trip lease, no. We do require evidence of insurance on the part of trip leasers before we will secure trip leasing. Now, we don't inadvertently grant trip leases to just anybody that calls and says, I've got a truck in Los Angeles and I need a load. We have to have at least some prior history with them in order to protect ourselves.
Okay. Now, the thing that continually comes up in these discussions is we've got to protect this guy because after all he might get hurt and then he wouldn't have any income. Who makes the mortgage payment on? They all have a mortgage on that.
That owner-operator makes the payment.
Okay. Give us a typical kind of a mortgage payment on those.
Yes. Of course, it depends on the amount of down payment, but I've seen some of these mortgage payments run at $1,100 a month. So it's a pretty healthy amount. In some cases, even a little higher, some cases a little lower.
Okay. So if someone has a $1,000 a month mortgage payment on his tractor, and he is, in fact, injured on the job, is that going to make the mortgage, his workers' comp going to make the mortgage payment on that tractor?
I doubt that the workman's compensation would make the mortgage payment, period. This is one of the options that every person who buys a piece of equipment has, is to buy protection when they buy the piece of equipment, and they're wise to do so. I did so on my own automobile, as a matter of fact.
But I'm talking about the amount.
The amount
the
of that?
The maximum amount of workers' comp would not
be
sufficient.
Oh, no. I don't believe it would be. Unless you're looking at a death, but as far as an injury, for instance, if a person was injured for, say, 3 weeks to a month, as an example, with respect to the operating cost of their piece of equipment, the mortgage payment and so forth, the offset would be nil. Week prorate, for instance, are on the basis of what the owner-operator earns. $1,300 a month, I believe, is assessed against earnings as earnings. In an average, this is averaging. Now, actually, retrospectively, some owner-operators probably show a considerable amount more than that. The man that runs the 1970 Kenworth that's paid for
is obviously going to be able to show a little more in personal earnings than the man with a 79 with a $1,200 to $1,300 payment. So these things fluctuate and slide tremendously.
So you're saying $1,300 a month is the base that SAFE uses for the self-employed?
This is basically what we understand it as, is that $1,300 a month is what the rate is assessed against on an average. And I think this is across the board average that they're using. Because of the fact that these are independent owner-operators, it's not unusual, for instance, for a man to earn $75,000 or $80,000, maybe even $90,000 a year with a piece of equipment. But in order to establish some averaging, they average it out at $1,300 a month in our fleet.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, do you have a question? Okay, just one. Say, you mentioned that 200 a month was killing you in reference to, I take it by that you meant Mitchell Brothers.
Maybe I should elaborate on that. When these individuals come into us, we have various methods of trying to solicit independent contractors, advertising for them various ways. When they contact us and want to talk to us about what our fleet average is per mile, different costs associated with it, and are notified that prior to signing a lease agreement with us, that they would be required to show us a workman's compensation policy, and then they inquire as to the cost of a workman's compensation policy in the state of Oregon for a truck driver, and we must tell them that it's around $200 per month. That's when it kills us. They say, well, you know, if I have to do that with you, why shouldn't I contract with XYZ company out of Texas, and I don't have that requirement with them? It's hard to answer.
Okay. Yeah, I was trying to recall the dates when Mitchell Brothers went basically with the lease operators. That was in about 74, I think we established. Before that, did you have many owner-operators?
We had individuals who owned their own trucks, but they were treated as company employees.
Right.
In other words, they were... we operated under an entirely different system at that time. Quite frankly, Chairman, I wasn't with the company at that time, and it'd be a little difficult for me to speak to them.
Okay, but at this time, you don't have any quote-unquote employees. You're all operators.
We do have actual company employees on the payroll who drive trucks for us.
Is that mainly local or is it long haul?
Primarily local to the states of Oregon, Washington.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Yes, that's good then. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Do you have any problem with the employment division?
Our case was one of the cases that was mentioned earlier, the Republic Burn Trucking and Mitchell Brothers.
I thought that was Republic Development.
That
they were talking about.
That's correct. That's correct. It was Republic Development. But it was joined. The cases were joined for hearing before the Supreme Court.
And you're involved now.
Were.
Mitchell.
Were. That is correct.
Right. Okay, let's not start hearing 27. Okay, Bob Kennedy.
Chairman, committee member, I'm Bob Kennedy, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, speaking in opposition to House Bill 2726. Now, the reason would be that most owner-operators of trucks will not have sufficient funds, insurance coverage, or other resources to maintain his or her family should they become industrial casualty. And that's what Representative Rogers was saying that I was going to say. The rates of dump truckers charged are not fixed by the Public Utilities Commission in Oregon as they are in Washington State. Therefore, the business is a dog-eat-dog business with much rate cutting, and persons getting into the business that do not know the amount of money it costs to maintain a dump truck. To also cut rates, thinking if the truck is working, they are making money, when in fact they would be better off with the rig parked. By exempting owner-operators' truckers, most will run bare, without no insurance. And when they are injured, they will have to go on welfare if they can no longer work, or if the injury has made them a permanent total disability, then they may be rehabilitated by the Vocational Rehabilitation Division of the Department of Human Resources. In any event, you and I as taxpayers will pay the bill because they are not covered by workers' compensation. Workers' compensation provides a strategy of returning these people to work where welfare does not. Most large employers will require the owner-operator to obtain workers' compensation coverage, so they will not be liable for a lawsuit should the trucker become injured on the job site. The smaller employers will not know the law and will in some cases get stuck by a lawsuit for an injury on their job for a contract truck. My neighbor is a long-time dump truck owner-operator. He was involved in an accident in early January. He became involved in all the responsibilities of an independent trucker and forgot to renew his workers' compensation coverage, and therefore wasn't covered. When he went to the doctor for treatment, they asked him for whom he worked. He explained that he was a owner-operator. They insisted they wanted to know who he worked for, and which was a local sand and gravel company. Subsequently, sand and gravel company wound up with the claim and are now mad at my neighbor and will not any longer hire his truck. And I might say that he is still off injured, and he has finally truck has been rebuilt, and he has had somebody else driving. He feels that when an owner-operator puts his truck to work on any job, the employer should pay the worker's compensation because in some lease jobs, the company pays the TUCs and some other insurances. The bill on page 2, line 34, speaks of the owner-operator maintaining his truck. It is easy to get behind in paperwork when a person is working long hours and when not driving, performing maintenance on the vehicle. This bill would be another step to let more people out and leave fewer persons over which to spread the risk, which is a philosophy of insurance. Therefore, we oppose House Bill
2627.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. I see correction.
Roger.
Bob, you say here on the second page, the company pays the TUC and some other insurance. What kind of insurance would that be?
Well, it's on some of this cargo or the whole bit, depending on, I was referring to other types of lease operations. As a matter of fact, once upon a year I had aspirations of going long haul, and after I figured it out, I'd done a little better calculating and knew I could make better money by driving somebody else's. And that's what I did, but I was talking about, for instance, some of the furniture moving to operation. And they, all you have is the tractor. Well, they're all over the lot. Some places have been testified to earlier. Some people have a tractor, some have a complete tractor and a combination, whatever the job calls for. And in some of those cases, you are an employee. There's just no two ways about it. Whether you believe it or not, you do go when they say, and because if you don't, as they just testified to, somebody else goes, and you still have your payments to make.
You know what I'm talking about when I say working hurts, quote, working hurts. People who are self-employed tend to do this more than an employee would, someone who is really a true employee.
Well, I think that sort of depends on the individual. Now, you and I both know there's a few chiselers out there. And I'm not going to argue that point with you.
Yeah. What point of making is the guy's got $1,200 a month mortgage payment, or $1,000 or $800 or $350 on the rig. He has to work, or he can't make that payment promise. And so he does this, and the point is that if these people are brought into the workers' comp system across the board, they will, and I suspect, and will work, the workers' comp people can expect this question when they get up there, to show us the kind of premium that is paid now on the owner-operators contracted with these companies and the amount of benefits they paid out. I would suspect that the benefits paid out are a minute portion of the premiums paid for those people. And they do have the effect then of holding down the rate for all the other two employees. Because, and that's a spread of risk, but they don't have the same risk that the two employees have.
I hope we remember this argument when we get on to some other bills with regard to rate setting, because as far as I'm concerned, that is really where I think you're working toward. However, it appears to me that if some of these people are only making $1,300 a month, something that's not too good, because the people that I used to negotiate for, as a matter of fact, if the last report I had from the person who took my place, if they kept going at the rate they were going to make $36,000 this year, and they don't own nothing. They drive it. And that's why I say that the $1,300, I think that if some of these folks are doing better than that, some of them probably are only coming out with the $1,300.
I think the $1,300 is what is used as the base for the self-employed individual. If he makes zero that month in net profit, he still has to pay on
$1,300. Well,
if he has a breakdown and has to spend $2,000 to repair his rig, he still pays on $1,300.
Well, it's like this a little bit further. This neighbor across the street, he has one unit right now, or he'll get more if need be. And the thing about this, he will hire a driver. And that's the reason he had a number, is because he does hire a driver. And I would say he's hurt now, and so he has somebody else on the unit, which he doesn't like to do.
People who testified earlier, who pays for your fees under the owner-operator's operation that you have, for example? Who pays the road tax? You pay the road tax. Is that consistent industry-wide? Is that what everybody does? Is that what you people do? Do you people pay the road tax? That's part of your... Is it yes or no?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, right. Yes. You pay that?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, I just wanted to know.
Good answers. I'm not saying your answers aren't great, but I'd like to have them on the record and identified who's giving them. So let's ask one a question of somebody, and if they would identify themselves, and maybe you gentlemen would like to come up, and if you would.
Mr. Page, I'll ask you if you'd like.
Because I do want to get these answers on the record. Carl, did you
justify.
Oh. I just been concerned because that does seem in my mind have some bearing on who, whether you employ them or whether you whether they are independent operators.
Don't worry about
you indicated. So tell me about how this works.
Okay, with Mitchell Brothers, and I'm sure the other carriers will back me up on this. Each state bills the motor carrier, in other words, the certificated carrier. Our interstate operating authority from the Interstate Commerce Commission is registered with each of the states in which we operate, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, whatever. Each state bills the certificated carrier, the named carrier. That carrier, as between the owner-operator, the motor carrier, and the state entity, that carrier is liable for those taxes.
So,
however,
so hence you pay them.
We pay them, we report them, we must report them to the state. That's the state, Oregon state law is the same as any other state in this respect.
Okay.
We report them and we pay them. We are the entity that the state audits when they want to check our books. As between the motor carrier and the owner-operator, however, as a condition of contract, that owner-operator is required to pay his proportionate share,
which is the exact amount you pay.
Well, okay. Taxes are computed on the number of road miles that all of our trucks travel.
Okay.
Say we have 100 trucks, they travel 100,000 miles, but one owner-operator travels 2,000 of that 100,000 miles. He is billed for 2/100ths of that. Am I making myself clear? He is billed for his proportionate share. If he only ran 500 miles, he wouldn't be billed for 2,000 or one.
So in effect, everything that you pay, you charge back to the operator, is that correct?
That is correct.
Is that consistent with what you do?
That is consistent on the highway use tax when we are get involved in interstate commerce on TUC taxes. As Oregon doesn't recognize a sub-haul or owner-operator operation, it doesn't apply. California, however, it does, and the .333 we pay and absorb.
In California.
In California.
But so here we have to pay it and you charge it back to the operator.
That's it, but that's only in interstate commerce now.
Okay, how about in Oregon then?
We have no Oregon TUC as retrospective to owner operators because Oregon doesn't recognize them. So we can't use owner operators in Oregon.
Oh, I see.
In Oregon TUC.
No, I see. Okay.
That's true for us also. We do not use the owner operator on an in clause state basis.
That's why you have your own trust for that.
That's correct.
So the operator pays for that one way or another.
That's correct. All expenses associated with owning, maintaining, and operating the truck are borne by the owner operator.
Does that include the cargo insurance?
That's correct.
Boone has a little different situation. We, on any deductible, split the deductible on 50-50 on this. We pick up half the deductible.
That's picked up in your tariff, though.
No.
Mm-hmm. When you say your deductible, what's the deductible?
On any accident. That includes
the
cargo loss or a liability. We pick up one half of the deductible loss.
But they pay the premium.
But they pay the premium. But we pay it and deduct it.
I see.
Okay, Carl?
Carl Frederick with Associated Oregon Industries. I'd like to speak very briefly in support of House Bill 2726 with the suggested amendments offered by Representative Lombard. I would agree with the gentleman from Mitchell Brothers who indicated the measure as amended would make Oregon much more consistent with federal law regarding the determination of who is an independent contractor, who is an employee. And I would leave with your committee a copy of the National Labor Relations Board decision in 1974, which touches on this subject in considerable detail, gives the standard for destruction control and this type of thing, and concludes generally the entrepreneurial nature of the owner-operator modus operandi is reflected by the fact that he is an individual with a substantial capital investment in equipment, which he purchases without any assistance from the employer, alleged employer, when he then, which he then utilizes to produce income for himself. And in view of the foregoing, the board concluded that the single owner operators are independent contractors. I wanted to touch very briefly on a comment made by Mr. Kennedy, which always disturbs me. Not Mr. Kennedy, but the comment. The philosophy of workers' compensation speaks of an employer-employee relationship. And I think the courts in the state of Oregon in particular, the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have done violence to what is an employer-employee relationship in this particular area, both for unemployment insurance, and you've seen it with your discussion of 2173, I'm sure, and with discussion in this case, and other bills we've had in the past. There is such a thing as a small entrepreneur in the state of Oregon. There is such a thing as a small independent contractor, and there's nothing wrong with it. And I think you expressed it very well, Representative Rogers. He takes certain risks, and among them, being not having protection for himself if something occurs. And there's nothing wrong with that, and that's basically part of our system. As far as the fiscal impact, I couldn't find anything with respect to this particular bill, but 2820, was it, from last session, did an evaluation when they brought the log truckers in, and apparently there was none, 2820, I guess it was, there was no fiscal impact. Very much as you said, more came in than went out, and I presume that would be true here. And the evaluation was that there would be absolutely no impact from news of this type.
One quick question. Are you saying no fiscal impact with the...
On the overall system, as far as, in other words, other classifications picking up what may be a deficit in benefits, something like that? Absolutely none.
My next question is, where do we stop?
The point is, these people should not have been added to the system because, as I say, workers' compensation embraces an employer-employee relationship. I do not personally feel that these folks are employees or workers. They are true independent contractors. And again, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, there is a fiscal impact statement. Mm-hmm. Yes, in your folder on the bill.
Chairman.
Undetermined minor amount of premium revenue may be lost. That's not basically what it says.
Yeah, last session
Safe decided to expect many truck drivers to elect for self-coverage.
Well, the thing says premium revenue. It doesn't say anything about net cost. There's a premium revenue. All they're saying is that somebody may opt out if they think they can get out from under it. Certainly we expect that, but what Representative Rogers was talking about, whether or not they hadn't been charging more dollars than they've been putting out in the way of losses, so the net cost would be...
Well, I presume you could get that information, perhaps.
We'll try.
Find out the classification and ask them what the experience is. It would give some of those reflections. Of course, not all of those people might classify as an independent contractor.
Carl, if we take this step as proposed here, under either the original bill or the proposed amendment, would you have any objection then to taking the option away from self-employed people? So they could not elect into workers' comp coverage?
I'm curious as to why you'd want to do that.
Well,
we've
heard before that there's adverse selection. You know what adverse selection is.
Yeah.
That's where someone who cannot get commercial coverage for a health and accident would opt in, and someone, for whatever reason, he could not get, he would opt in, the other person who's young, healthy, and that would buy the commercial coverage.
If the experience reflects that type of philosophy or that experience, I would say then you have an argument to do so. But I don't believe that is the case.
I don't either, but I just would you support that?
If what you say is correct, of course I would.
You're a hedge.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't then. As I believe the situation exists from an actuarial standpoint, I would say no.
But you would want to.
I'd want to keep.
Have the option.
Would want to keep 656-128 as it is right now, okay. Giving me the option to do so. I may be in.
You're getting as bad as some of the bureaucrats.
Well, at least I haven't been held in contempt there.
Well, as a matter of fact, though, clearance modification takes care of part of this in the first place. So, you know, you really, if you talk about somebody having adverse selection in the workman's comp business, it doesn't occur as much because they have an experience modification. If, in fact, they have any experience to modify, we're just trying to take it away from them.
One quick question. What segment of AOI do you represent in this particular issue?
I'm kind of a true renaissance man. I represent everybody. I was trying to figure out what place you could fit. So a number of our members, I would imagine, fall under the category of wanting this particular protection, or lack of protection, or choice.
I gathered you probably weren't really supporting any section. You were just
No,
overall,
it's a general
free enterprise.
Yes, this is a general free enterprise argument. Is that acceptable, Representative Johnson?
I'd like to discuss it freely.
All right. We have some trucking lines that our members of ours, if that answers your question.
That'll be free for the record.
Okay, thanks, Carl.
You're welcome. Bill or Roy Green, Joe? Homes here. Or do you have any comments on this one?
No. He's
trying to
run out the door.
Where did you hear? Why don't we take 5 minutes?
Yeah, why don't we take
After this.
Yes,
we've
been out first time.
Oh, there's still
an appointment. We've got that bill passed.
I hope so. Any comments at all on this?
Mr. Chairman, you're still on 2724,
right,
are you not? I don't have any comments of my own. Ours is a position that we hold no position on. We will administer whatever you determine.
Okay. Is there any technical information we need?
I just thought Representative Rogers had a question.
I do have. Would it be appropriate to ask you or to ask Place for information pertaining to, one, the amount of premiums collected by those people who are supposedly owner-operators now, and two, the amount of benefits that have been paid out to that same site? Or are they so swallowed up in the whole system if they can't be separated out?
There is a group that's administered by one carrier that perhaps I can get that information for you. However, I believe SAFE could extract that from their statistics. Their statistics are far superior to, very candidly, to those of the private sector, because they have, over a long period of time, existed in that type of situation.
Okay, why don't we then close the hearing on 27-26. And we will take it. Labor Committee will come to order. Clerk will take note of those present. Hearing on House or Senate Bill 371.
I like to get into one like that.
I
didn't like it when I put ribbon in the back.
But Larry Young,
back to Kirsten 40.
If you will share your lawful knowledge with us and first off,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Larry Young. I'm the Administrator of the Compliance Division of the Workers' Compensation Department. I've been requested to explain the circumstances that have led up to have prompted the Senate Bill 371 engrossed. If I may briefly give a background. During the 77th session, Senate Bill 1048 was passed, and putting the statute as ORS 656-209 and 727. This provides for the offset of Social Security benefits against workers' compensation from a total disability benefit. Prior to this legislation, and the effective date of this act, by the way, was 7178. Prior to this, the Social Security Administration laws require that workers' compensation benefits received by a Social Security Administration recipient or beneficiary be offset against those Social Security benefits, except in those situations where the state exercises that right. And 1048, state exercised that right. The 209, which is basically in this 371, says a permanently total disabled worker receiving Social Security disability benefits. There's two situations where this happened. A worker was injured prior to 7178, permanently total disabled before then. When the law came into effect, there was supposed to have been a transfer. The Social Security Administration was taking the offset amount, was offsetting his permanent total disability benefit. The state took over, and there was no change. When we started organizing to go into effect on 7178, we began in January of 1978 to receive release information from the affected workers to obtain the benefit information from the Social Security Administration. As an example, one case, we asked for information on 1/30/1978. Social Security Administration advised us that they would have the information within 2 months. But July 1 came up, and we were supposed to send out the authorization for actually in June. We received nothing from Social Security Administration. The insurer is required to continue paying the permanent total disability payment. Finally, on one case on March 28, 1979, 3 years ago, we received the benefit information for one worker whose authorization went out on 4/3. Actually went out today, offsetting $368.50, effective 7/1/1978. So since 7/1/1978, the insurer has been paying him an overpayment of $368.50 per month. This amounts to a $685 overpayment to that worker, which by 7274, which is being taken out of this, requires and has the right to recover that amount. So if we've asked the insurers on these overpayment situations to collect 10% of the amount the worker has left in overpayment per month, monthly overpayment, 10% per month or $50 a month, whichever is less. So in this case, they would be recovering $36.85 a month for 100 months or 8 1/3 years. And basically, what Section 2 does of this bill is waive those overpayments created by this delay in information. Both, there was about 1,000 cases affected that were permanently total disabled before 7/1 that had overpayment periods of 2 months, and we are still receiving this information from maybe 10 or 11 months of overpayment or more. The other situation is under the Social Security Administration, when they approve an application for Social Security benefits, there is usually a 5-month waiting period. And then on top of that, there could be a 2-month or 3-month period while we're receiving the benefit information so we can keep the offset amount. So that by the time the actual amount of offset is known to the department, so an authorization can be issued, then it could be a period of from 6 to 8 months of overpayment again to the workers. The section 4 of the 209 that's been added on page 2, lines 13 through 15, authorizes the offset to be, the effective date of the offset to be set by the department so as not to create the overpayment. That's the administrative situation that prompted this legislation and the engrossed version. I was also asked to speak to the difference between the initial bill and the engrossed. The situation with 371 as it was is that as it's worded, it would also affect 268, which allows for it to actually speak to any overpayment. Whereas the intent was strictly to manage the Social Security Administration program problem. And as 371 is originally, it would affect the ability of the insurer to recover overpayment under 268. So we worked with the Legislative Council and the engrossed version, also through, done through Representative Grinnell's office and things like that.
Well, Senator Scott, a couple of quick questions. One, are the payments different when they go from disability to retirement benefits? Are the amounts paid different? Is that what the issue is or not?
No.
Did these people get an increase in payments? Or did they, what caused them to owe the money exactly? I guess that,
okay.
I hate to say it one way, but I have to say there must be a reason why they didn't know they were being overpaid.
Social Security Administration removed their offset on 7/1/1978. That is the date that our law became effective as far as offset.
Okay.
So had we had the information prior to 7/1/78, there would have been no overpaid from the insurer's side.
But didn't you know what those offsets were going to be?
No. We don't know what the offset amount is going to be until we get the benefit information as far as what the worker's primary insurance amount is, what his auxiliary is receiving, what his total family benefit is from the Social Security side. And then with that information, we can see the amount of offset.
Did you notify them that there was, that their benefit position was going to change?
The ones that were in effect prior to
7/1,
yes, prior to that, we told them that there should not be any, there should be no change in their benefit amount, and there is a Social Security overpayment problem, and that in a lot of cases the worker was not reporting, or the Social Security Administration was not recording what the worker was reporting his Social Security, his worker's compensation benefits amount. So when they got the information, they found out that, hey, we've been overpaying you since you became permanently totally disabled, and so therefore we're going to recover an overpayment. So they did not, when they removed their offset, they did not increase it up to the amount they removed. They continued removing the amount they were offsetting to recover overpayment. So then there was a considerable difference in the amount of combined benefit the worker was receiving.
Okay, if that offset's forgiven, who's going to pay it? The state of Oregon, or who?
For these, the ones we're talking about, it would be just only the workers' comp side. It would be the state of Oregon, yes.
The state of Oregon would pay out of the...
Now, this is just on the workers' compensation benefit side.
Okay. Do you have any idea how much money that is?
We, just very roughly, we ran an average on 497 claims, and I think the average amount of offset was $242. So,
$20,000
per month. And depending on the average month delayed information, which we have, for a lot of these cases, it's been running about 2.5 months is the average amount of delay in time getting the information from the Social Security Administration. So for that group prior to 7-1, we're talking about 1,000 cases times 242 a month times 2.5 months, which is a loss on that side. Now for the other side, as workers are now becoming reduced permanent until disabled, the amount of offset will be greater because their social security benefits will be higher. And so you'd be talking about whatever the average is now for a social security recipient times we get about, I suppose it's probably 15 or so a month that would be affected by social security disability.
So those are 7-1, and roughly $500,000 worth of liability that we're going to pick up, is that correct? 1,000 times 249, something like that, for 2.5 months. Mm-hmm. Roughly $500,000 to $600,000 we're going to pick up in
which is really being waived, yes.
Being waived. Or is it being waived, or is it going to come out of somebody's pocket? Let's be sure of that.
Yeah.
Is it coming out of the general fund, or is it just being...
Representative Johnson, if I may, I'm Chris Allison, I'm Assistant Attorney General assigned to the Workers' Compensation Department. You have to remember that what we're talking about here is that these monies have been reserved previously by the insurance carrier for the injuries occurring prior to July of 1977. This is all part of the package. Now, at that time, when ORS 656209 was passed and so forth, this offset permitting us to change the approach to entitlement was, in effect, already paid, already reserved. What this was going to do is, in fact, what we're talking about principally is we're talking about the retroactive reserve, which makes up the bulk of the older claims, the highest cost of the older claims, plus the statutory benefit. Now, when we administer the Social Security offset, any recovery or any offset authorized, the director, and it was so testified, and the purpose was to reduce rates, would apply principally to the statutory amount first. And then any offset greater than that statutory amount applied to reduce the retroactive reserve. So the bulk of the cost that you're talking about here is not coming for free from anyone. It's already in the system. But the bulk of the expense of it is to the retroactive reserve. It will affect some of the old reservings that they're supposed to change back, probably, to whatever tune. Like you said, $500,000 or maybe a little higher amount. But initially, this was a saving, roughly speaking, of $3 to $4 million, and will be a saving in the future as it applies to the particular rate structure. But this money is there. It's not coming per se from anywhere.
If we didn't forgive this, would it reduce?
It will
rate for anybody eventually?
No, it might. To my knowledge, it will not, because most of the forgiveness is retroactive reserve. Now, it might make some difference whether or not we could accelerate and increase the prior benefits. We're 1 year behind in the retroactive reserve because we're not able to bring the older injuries up to the current level. But what the effect of the rates, if anything, I don't know, but I doubt if it's going to have any effect of the rates. It might affect the plugging back in the reserve. The reserving, theoretically, I don't know if it actually occurred. Mr. Green can explain the rates. But the reserving that was reserved on these old permit totals should have been changed because of the advent of Senate Bill 1048. Last session, and reserving should be reduced because of the we're receiving the offset. But whether this, we don't believe that this 371 is really going to have a substantial effect one way or the other.
I had several people contact me when they were notified they were.
I don't know.
And the concern, I guess I didn't understand about it. One thing I didn't understand was why weren't they notified that their payments were in jeopardy. That would be the thing that would interest me, because they indicated they had no notification of any kind that their payment was perhaps in jeopardy.
Until August of 2008, we did not know their payments were in jeopardy.
when we sent out our notice, in fact, we said that there shouldn't be, you shouldn't see any difference in your benefits, your combined benefits at all.
Let me interject one thing, Larry. At that time, that when that notice was sent out, that was the intent, was to tell them that they would not lose any benefits. Isn't that correct? They would remain about the same.
The economists would remain the same. Right. And this is what we talked about, is that there should be, per se, a kind of a flip-flop. Social Security would take an X number of dollars off that. Social Security now would pay X number of dollars, and we would take that off that. That's what the entitlement situation. But the problem with this is that there, in dealing with Social Security, there's so many variables and timeliness of it. In other words, what has happened here, for example, is every time that we authorize an offset retrospectively, we have in fact created an overpayment under the workers' compensation system, and there is in fact an underpayment under the Social Security system. That's what happened. And there's so many variables in the figures that you receive from Social Security, the timeliness, the dropping off of total family benefits versus TIA and the whole ballgame. So it has created quite an administrative problem.
Now, this is basically really, in reality, a one-shot deal.
Yes, it is.
For
the bulk of them, but it's still going to occur in the future.
In the future ones, there'll be...
But there'll be timely as they go along.
There'll be lesser times when you get a better handle on getting information from the Social Security Administration. It's just the same. It's going to be either from 6 to 8 months on every new, if the worker isn't already receiving Social Security benefits when he's determined PTD. If he is required to apply for Social Security benefits after he has declared PTD, they're going to be paying regular payments until such time as we get information to make the offset computation. Whatever that period of time is, from the time that we start receiving Social Security benefits until we become aware of the amount so we can make the computation, that would be normally, under the present statute, be an overpayment. Whatever that period is, and it's not going to be that many. Most of them will have applied and be receiving Social Security disability benefits prior to being determined permanently totally disabled. So then we'll be talking about only a month or a month or two overpayment.
Now, the original big problem, some of that, at least in our area, seemed to be caused by Social Security ignoring the information that had been sent out to them. Is that all caught up now?
No, sir, it isn't.
So we still have the potential of some of those.
They put a moratorium on those recoveries,
okay,
until Congress could review it, and they haven't done anything that I'm aware of yet. And if they decide to go back and allow them to recover, we had some workers who have been PTD for 10 years, and they swear and bring copies of what they sent to the Social Security Administration, but Social Security Administration did not record it, did not put it in the system. So for those 10 years, they've been paying them the amount they were receiving in workers' comp benefits on top of
it. So this actually triggered some attempted recoupment by Social Security going way back in time, not
sure,
just for that one period of time. So, and now what happens, let's say that Congress ultimately decides to not forgive those and in fact allow Social Security to go ahead and recoup, then what is going to be the effect of this particular bill?
This bill would only affect recovery by the state insurer for the overpayment he made on workers' compensation permanent total disability benefits, and would not relieve any of the Social Security overpayments at all.
Okay, so those people, the worker is stuck if he do not get that permanent relief, because he's going to have to take Social Security because of the then existing law.
Yeah. But there still is provision under the Social Security law that the Social Security Administration does away those overpayments in the case of hardship, and they have done a few of those.
All right. So now, You talked about this being essentially a one-shot operation. It should be very minimal in the future, but the potential exists. There's going to be some of these ongoing.
Yes, there will, Representative Rogers, and I don't know.
You don't know.
We don't have enough experience yet to really tell what it's going to be.
I had an earlier discussion with the under Murphy's Law, and it's going to happen, just for no other reason. And if you don't have any idea how much.
I really can't say. I it's going to be from 2 to 8 months, probably, but I don't know the number that's going to be involved, and so I really can't come up with a figure.
That's fine.
Well, I don't know what the average amount's going to be either. Really.
Okay, and now, just in order to kind of get a picture of what's really taking place, let's say you've got someone that's permanently total disabled, let's say in 1975 or 76, and they've been receiving, what is it, figure $750 a month workers' comp. Is that about correct? Somewhere in that area, let's say. And then the Social Security comes along and they're paid $385 or something like that. That those are figures in the ballpark, aren't they, I guess an average case. Okay, so then so then this, when Social Security comes into play, the offset cut the workers' comp portion.
If I can put it this way, let's say, assuming the workers' comp benefits, which are normally the case, higher than
right
than the Social Security benefits, the worker under the Social Security, in the future, he is eligible to receive 80% of his ACE as a maximum benefit under Social Security. Our workers' comp is higher.
Let's go, ACD.
ACE. Average current earnings, which is the figure that Social Security utilizes. But the workers' comp is a maximum, say, of $700. So his benefit entitlement is going to be $700. If he receives $300 from Social Security, and that is his principal insurance amount, and there's all kind of variations in there, but stay with the principal insurance amount, $300. We would pay under the comp system $400 so that he would still get the maximum, which would be the $700 fee. Now, you will have some variations of that when the workers' comp benefits, in some cases, might be less, then you have to make sure that his total entitlement would be 80% of the ACE, and you would see that he got 80% of the ACE. So we might say, we'd bring him up to at least the 80% of the workers' comp benefits, but that would be his entitlement.
Okay, but what has happened is that they said that you were overpaid for several months.
Well, may I? If I could take you back, if we could just use some round figures, and I don't.
That's what we want to
do. The ACE and the total family benefit, and that it gets confusing. For anything prior to 7178, say that the workers' comp is paying $1,000, and the worker was also entitled to Social Security benefits of $500 total, and like I said, there's various ways. Under their law, they would have reduced their Social Security benefits down to zero. So he would still be receiving $1,000. On 7178, they were to remove their offset, pay him $500. We would authorize a $500 offset amount. So he'd be being paid $500 on the workman's comp side, but his total amount received would still be $1,000.
Right.
And unfortunately, they weren't aware that he was receiving $1,000, so they may have been paying him $500 and he was receiving $1,000 on the workman's comp side. So his combined money he was receiving was $1,500, but his total entitlement was still $1,000. So, hey, we paid you $500 too much since back then, and you have this overpayment.
Okay. Okay, that's what I want to make sure the committee understands.
And that
so
is
that $500.
But this is not the only thing about that $500 on the Social Security side. It's when we did not get the information until September that his offset amount should have been $500, and the effective date of that offset amount should have been July 1 to the insurance carrier here in the state. Mm-hmm. They overpaid him for the months of July and August $500 for each one of those months, or a total overpayment of $1,000. With this bill, we'll be able to say, when we get the information, say we get 2 months, okay, next month, your offset amount is this much. We're not going to go back and pick up the effective date. So, therefore, he hasn't overpaid that amount.
Mr. Chairman, could I run back one other way on that same thing? Did I hear you correctly that the person who was receiving these payments got an increase of $500 in payments from Social Security at a point, X point, when he became eligible? And he just took the money and ran, so to speak. And when they came to collect it back, then he's now coming to us to look for recovery. Am I wrong?
Well,
I'm using this as an example. Is that what happened or isn't it?
I don't know if he took it and ran as a thing.
He's reported all of a sudden he got a $500 increase in benefits.
No,
is that correct? Is that, or am I wrong?
He actually, at July 1, he got a decrease because Social Security was not taking the appropriate offset. They're required by the federal law to take an offset. And for whatever reason, there were three reasons they didn't do it. They didn't put it into the computer, the worker didn't report, or the local Social Security office didn't report back to the federal office, to the Baltimore office. But for whatever reason, it didn't get into the system that he was getting workers' compensation benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever he got workers' compensation benefits, the Social Security Administration was supposed to reduce his Social Security benefits by the amount. Well, if they didn't know it or didn't do it, then they continued paying him the total entitlement he was due. On 7-1, when the law went into effect, they were supposed to remove any offset they were taking. They should have been paying less, but they weren't for any one of those three reasons.
Did your payments go up then at that point, 7-1?
Our payments went, the state payments went down by the amount of the offset we authorized.
Okay.
I'm trying to keep this all straight using the funds from an apple.
I'm understanding.
And I don't know if I got there or not. Because I thought an example in 371-78, where the person was entitled to $1,000 worth of comp, Social Security would be $500, but they deducted. Social Security deducted $500 off, okay, and so, but the guy still ends up with $1,000
right.
From the fee system. Post 7178, which is what I don't know.
On 7178, the Social Security Administration removed their offset. So they had been taking away $500.
So all of a sudden, the person gets a $500 check from Social Security.
Right. And at the same time,
still getting the $1,000 check from workers' comp.
No, at the same time, we sent out authorization saying that they can offset $500 and reduce.
What do you mean the insurance carrier?
Yes, can reduce their payment by $500.
Right.
So now they're paying only $500 instead of
$1,000.
Right. Social Security is paying $500. And in total, he's still receiving the $1,000 he was prior to 7178. And that's what our offset authorization is.
The problem was there's a lag time.
There's a lag time.
There's a lag time where the person was, quote unquote, overpaid. And so the insurance carriers were then told, go back and collect what you overpaid, which is the notices these folks are getting now.
Yeah.
And that they're going to take 10% of the total amount of what they overpaid and deduct from what they're getting now in workers' comp. That's basically how it's being worked, right?
Right?
And over the, whatever it is, 70 months, 72 months, 84 months.
On these two cases I mentioned, it's taken a year to get the benefit information from Social Security Administration.
Right.
So that's 10 months of overpayment on the insurer's side.
Yeah.
These are just a few of these. I think there's probably less than 100 of these that we were still waiting to get the information after January the 1st. So the majority of those are less than 6 months old.
So it's basically because of the lag time between the workers' comp award or payment and the Social Security.
From getting the release from the worker to get the information from Social Security, getting it back to Baltimore, and getting Baltimore back to us,
right.
That lag time is...
And that's where the overpayment is done.
Yes,
sir.
Right. Good. Mike, just a couple of technical questions.
Well, it's technical, but still don't understand what I'm dealing with.
Each of problems are taken care of in the example B, and that's addressed in section 3 and subsection 4 of the bill. Is that correct?
Yes.
Could, Mr. Chairman, could you put in writing an example of exactly how that goes, and so that I can understand? I'll have to say I still think I'm lost with this thing. The other thing is, did the claimant receiving the payment ever get more money that he knew of? Did he get more money than he did before at any one point, and or not? Did his rates stay level until this change occurs, or did he get an increase in his income? Or in another phrase, did he have any way of knowing he was being overpaid? Let's ask it that way.
I really can't answer that from the Social Security side. Some of the we've got to talk to a lot of them personally many times, and some of the information they get from the Social Security Administration is confusing. And I'm sure some of them never knew there would be no overpaid at all from the Social Security side. I'm sure some of them were aware that they were. I don't.
Could you just put a couple of examples on paper and furnish it to us of how those differences occurred, and maybe I can understand it better.
I'll be glad to.
Let me give you a little example how something like this can occur. Somebody gets that check, and all of a sudden it's for more than what they've been getting. And they look at it, and wow, their eyes light up and say, they give me a raise for some reason. They brag about it and talk about it to the neighbor or somebody like that. And say,
is there some onion here?
Well, I don't know why, but don't say, don't gripe. You got an increase.
Well, that's what I asked him, and he kept saying that they never got more bucks, yeah. And that's why I don't understand, I have to say.
Well, ladies, you say that, he says it does, they didn't.
Okay.
The situation arose in each one prior to 7178, most of them did not experience an increase in the amount of
not at that time.
Combined benefits they were getting.
They just put in their pockets, did not go up.
It
prior to 7-1.
Yeah, in most cases it went down because in most cases the Social Security was paying more to the worker than what he was entitled to. And so in most cases it went up on 7-1, and then it went down for them because we reduced the workers' comp side. And Social Security said they were going to increase the offset, but nothing came up. They'd already been paying them their maximum benefit for their total entitlement.
Another thing that you should remember in here, and this is what's confusing sometimes to workers and so forth, is that the workers do receive a cost of living increase from Social Security. They also receive the RR from the workers' comp. They should not be and will not in the future be considered in computing the offset. But this has created some problems, especially on the old one, too.
What's on
the retroactive reserve? This is where there's 12 cents from the retroactive reserve, 6 cents from the employers, and 6 cents from the employees that go into rates, the prior injury up to the current benefit level.
Okay, we'll
on the first page of the bill, Andros, it states that the line 7, it states the board. Should that be department? Will the board or the department be?
I think that's going to come up.
That's a policy decision to be made. When 1048 was passed, it was the Workers' Compensation Board. I think
I recall, Bill Holcomb might be here.
Yeah.
On that, and I think he would prefer to have this transferred to the department. I don't believe there's any reason why it shouldn't be the department.
I think there's going to be some discussion on that in just a minute.
Okay, why don't we move on, and Bill, why don't you come on up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Holmstrom, Executive Assistant to the Workers' Compensation Board. Actually, I'm here with a intent not to particularly speak for the bill, but I think that I want to bring to the committee's attention that this provision of the law, as noted here and as brought up previously, has been within the bounds of practical administration within the department, the workers' comp department. And the law here, as we read it, signifies that this is a responsibility of the board. Now, the board has delegated this responsibility to the department. But I would bring to the committee's attention that this is somewhat confusing and sometimes confusing to a number of people in regards to this offset, disability offset to the workers' compensation check that he receives. And this is an administrative function. And I believe that it might behoove the committee to consider taking the board completely out of the administration of this particular provision of the law and put it into the department where, for all practical purposes, it is being administered now. As I say, it does cause some confusion. It isn't something I imagine that's life or death in regards to the legislation, because the board still could, by authority it has by law, delegate this authority to the department. But it is confusing to people when they see the board and then the department is doing it, and they don't know really who's in charge. And we get a number of inquiries regarding this, or have. And they all, we have, of course, we have to turn them over to Mr. Young and his department, who handles this particular phase of it. And I'm sure that the intent of the people behind this is not to create any section within the board to do this particular administrative function, because we're certainly not set up to do it. And rightly so, it is an administrative function of the department. So therefore, I'd like the committee to consider possibly changing that particular language. I might add, too, Mr. Chairman, that and members of the committee, that I discussed this with the Senate members of Senate Labor, and they are in complete concurrence with what I'm saying today. And this was an oversight that was, after the bill was engrossed, I thought it was going to be a part of the engrossing, but it was not. So therefore, I don't know of any particular opposition to it.
Bill, that amounts to basically just changing where the reference is made to the board.
Yes,
the reference
is to the department rather than the board. Right.
That's true. And I found, just skipping along through, I found on the first page of the bill, line 7, line 10, and maybe more, line 13, and then page 2, line 10, line 17, line 21, line 24. I think, now in each case, I haven't read it, so I don't know for sure, but in each case where the board is mentioned, we would change that to department.
Well,
isn't that basically it?
Yeah. Now, what I could do, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, is, with your permission, I'll have some amendments drafted to submit to your committee in regards to this, or if the have legislative counsel, it's, I think, mostly housekeeping, if the committee wishes to pursue this any further.
Representative Rogers.
Since I thought this was part of the board's function, I saved the question. Sorry, and so I'll ask you anyway. We'll get back to this part of it, but this has emergency clauses, no specified date. Based on some actions taken previously on some legislation, they like to have a specific date to work with because that makes an orderly transition. Does that apply in this case, or is Cliff the appropriate one to ask if we're going to give it back to the department?
Well, I think that as Mr. Young testified previously, these are you've got two things here. You've got this basically this one-shot deal, which is the group of people that were paid that the records were not available either, and I think you mentioned a couple of times, either through the failure of the worker to notify the department or the board of their receiving their check from the government, or the Social Security failing to notify them, or some miscalculation in their computer or something like that. In other words, it wasn't the fault of any particular one thing, and the blame isn't there, but the fact happened, the fact is it happened, and so therefore you're talking about that group which they now have a handle on. And so I think that they, when they talk about the effective date of this act, is in effect today, because they've got a handle on everything, and hopefully and supposedly from here on in. And I think that that's it. And that's Mr. Ellison and maybe
Representative Roger. I think we want it to be effective as soon as possible. And I think you hit in the bill upon half, which we thought would be the quickest way to do it. Yeah. If it passed here and back through and once in a while, we'd like to make it up.
Okay. You have no problem with changing the board to the department?
That's up to Mr. Green.
Mr. Green is here. He may want to comment on that.
I'm sure. We have no objection to the thing that should be under the department.
Then I would...
Go ahead, Roy. What can I do with your jump? No, belongs to...
My name is Roy Green. I'm the director of the Workers' Compensation Department. No, we have no objections. In fact, we're doing the work now anyway. The one thing I'd like to do for you, though, and perhaps it'll keep from showering you with a bunch of paper, I'd like to show on the blackboard exactly how the thing works. Would you like to see that?
Yeah.
It'll take about 3 or 4 minutes to go.
We've made a pledge in our caucus to be on the side, and we're...
That's 4 minutes.
This is that we haven't made that kind of a pledge, just we don't have a caucus here.
Right. And so I'm going to leave. I appreciate you.
Why don't you go ahead?
You understand
it. I'll leave it on the blackboard for you.
I'll
tell you before. Okay, go ahead. You say about 3-4 minutes, Corey?
Okay.
Do you have any further questions with me, Mr. Chairman?
No, I guess that's it, Bill. If you can.
Why don't you get, we'll go with Mike and no.
All right,
fine. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I
want to say while that's happening, Mr. Patrick?
I'm here.
Okay, fine. We'll get to you right after this. Sir. And Bob?
Keeping that for office.
Here's an example. A worker whose actual so-called highest actual earnings, $14,400 a year, which is $1,200 a month. Now, 80% of that is basically his benefit level. And 80% of $1,200 is $960. Now, that's what he cannot get more than for this I don't get too involved. You can get more than that, but for this calculation, that is what you're supposed to get. Now, the worker gets, and this is an estimate now, let's say he gets $800 in worker's comp. And from Social Security, he gets $400 per month from Social Security. The total of his benefit then is $1,200 a month. Unfortunately, that's the same as this, but ignore that for now and all. All right, now, according to the Social Security law, he can only get, as far as they are concerned, $950 a month. Now, if the workers' compensation is in excess of $950, then the offset which the Social Security Administration took before was the entire amount of Social Security. It just eliminated it. If the amount of workers' comp is less than this highest, or 80% of the ACE or actual earnings, then the Social Security took an offset of the difference between this and the total benefit, which in this case would be $240. So there was a $240 Social Security offset. And this is the offset which the worker was supposed to have been, or his benefits were supposed to have been reduced by Social Security prior to July 1st, 48. Now, under the law, his entitlement is $960. The way he was getting it was, he was getting $800 from workers' comp and $160 from Social Security, which is $400 minus $240 offset, which is $160. And that's what he's receiving. Now that is the entitlement. As of July 1st of 48, all of the deal anticipated was that the entitlement would be exactly the same, except that the Social Security would go to $400. And workers' comp would go to $560, which is a total of $960. Now, what happened was that one of three things could. Either the worker did not tell them that he was getting workers' comp, or he told them and they didn't get in the computer, or he told them something happened that what didn't get in the computer. As a result, on the federal side now, we're talking not about this bill, but on the federal side, all of a sudden, as of July 1st of 1948, a lot of workers were notified that their benefits were cut off until the total accumulated overpayment on the federal side was recovered. And immediately, what it really did was just to cut the heart out of most of the income of these workers. The majority House leader and his staff interfered with Ullman, and Ullman told the Social Security Administration about, I think, 3 or 4 months ago, you will take no more overpayments, take no more recovery of overpayments until after we've had an overview of the method of how these overpayments accumulated. So currently, there is no attempt to recover on the federal side right now any of those overpayments. All right. Now, once we got into this on the side of the state, anytime, well, remember, effective now on July 1st, the Social Security, which was paying $150, went to $400. And the workers' comp supposedly was supposed to go from 800 down to 560. So the total of the 400 plus 560 is $950. Social Security reduced their payment, but they didn't give us any information to give to didn't give us any information so that we could give to the insurance carriers the proper amount of the offset, so they could reduce theirs. What has happened for 5 or 6 or 7 months? There's a quite a number of workers have been receiving the $800 plus the $400 from security, when they should have been receiving a total of $960. And this is an offset of the state now. So it's an overpayment in this case. So what this bill does is, for that group of people, says if you've collected any money from them to pay collect this overpayment, you pay it back to them. And whatever money hasn't been collected, or whatever overpayment hasn't been collected, is forgiven. So like that. The second type is the one.
We're doing another second type. How, Roy, before you go to the second type, how long did that, when did that overpayment start?
It could have started on July 1st, and mostly did on July 1st of
48.
So
they could have, in essence, received $260 more all of a sudden.
All of no, she didn't. Well, yes, it's possible. But in a lot of these, it didn't occur that way. He was receiving a total of $1,200. And this is where all the trouble began. Because we were involved in Oregon with the entitlement. But we didn't realize at that time that there were a lot of persons who were receiving, in effect, more than they were entitled to. Their entitlement was $960, but they were receiving $1,200.
And had for some time.
Right. Now, whether they knew about it or not, I think most of them actually didn't realize it, because we talked to several of them who actually have documentary evidence that they gave the information to the Social Administration, but somehow didn't get a computer. If it doesn't get a computer, okay, what to do with it? Didn't come out right. Anyway, we now have then a group of workers who have been receiving, in this case, $240 more per month than they should have. In some cases, it's been declared now to be an overpayment, and we have allowed, as Mr. Jones said, we have allowed them to recapture that at 10% of the net payment that the workers receiving, or $50 or whichever the lesser. What this bill would do then, it's just to say, you've collected so much on this overpayment, you pay it back to them. What they still owe, you got to eat it. In the words of one self. Now, the second type is this. The ones that are going to be made permanent totals over a period of time, and that's the only definite period, are always going to be about 4 or 5 months overpaid, because it takes about 5 months to get information out of the Social Security Administration. What we're saying is this: until we issue an order lowering the benefit, there is no overpayment, even though it might be 5 or 6 months. And the reason for it is this, and I'll show you what I'm going to show you enough. Well, you understand what's happening here.
Okay.
Everybody understand it? All right. Now, when this thing was passed by the legislature, in effect, there was a reduction in the incurred law that was reported and actually had to be set aside by the insurance carrier or the self-insurer. And it was a temporary life annuity. It was a temporary life annuity of the amount of offset. Because once that offset has been determined, then any increases in cost of living do not affect that offset. The offset will remain the same throughout the period of time. Now, let's assume a man becomes a permanent total now at age 50. There is then a temporary life annuity at age 50 for 12 years of The offset will again say $240. So you would have a temporary annuity for $240 per month at age 50 for 12 years. Now, as of the time that offset then, the affiliate is notified of this offset, they in effect reduce the amount of their incurred loss by the present value of that. And that goes into the rate making. And that is a huge thing because the rate making gets involved with this, even though that occurred 20 years ago. In other words, the man was injured 20 years ago. And it comes as a result of what is known as the calendar year experience. Rate making is involved half with calendar year experience and half with policy year experience. Calendar year experience is nothing more than a counting figure which says it cost us so many dollars this year for our incurred losses, and if we got so many dollars in earned premium. And those incurred losses to be adjusted for any years back. And the earned premiums to be premiums for 5 or 10 years back that they finally got from an employer or from an insurer. So it is nothing more than a counting thing. As a result, if they have a reduction in their reserve as of this year, that actually influences the rate. It reduces the amount of incurred loss in the calendar year calculation. And this is how this stuff gets into the rate. Everybody understand that now? All right, let's try it again.
No, I don't think I can understand, but I got to this last thing about the temporary life annuity.
All this is a temporary life annuity of $240 a month for 12 years, to manage 60. Now that is a reduction in the benefit, period. The present value of that reduction in the benefit is an actual reduction in the reserve required by either that insurer or the self-insurer. And therefore is a reduction in the cost to them. Now that gets back into the mix, as I say, as a result of this so-called calendar year experience calculation. And this is why, although perhaps some persons in my industry may not agree necessarily with it, but this is why that I'm not too unenthusiastic about this kind of a bill, because although this has gone into the rates already, the amount of the cost of repayment and the amount of the cost of not collecting the overpayments that have been made is rather small in relationship to the overall reduction in the incurred losses.
We didn't get a benefit in the rates then for
social security. Yes, we did already. It was already in there.
The
benefit is in there because of the fact that we anticipate we're going to have so many permanent totals each year, and they are assigned back quite a number of years. But they get into the rate as a result of this.
Kind of works this way. If there is a hike in Social Security benefits, when a worker is receiving a worker's comp benefit on a permanent total disability, if there's a hike and it goes past that 960 figure, for instance, then there is a drop in the worker's comp benefit.
No, okay. No more.
But prior
to. But no more.
now what we're having is, if there is a raise in the workers' comp benefit,
they will get the raise.
They will get that raise.
If there's a raise in Social Security, they will get that raise. They will get cost of living raises from now on out.
Right. But if it gets above a certain, or if it's right after 7178, if one was jumping over the other one was coming down, isn't that?
That's right.
Okay.
Equal.
Right. Right. So they say the total amount was remaining stable.
But on July 1, if we can do it via the retroactive reserve, on July 1, 1979, there probably will be an increase in the benefit to all permanent totals of that category. And unless Social Security changes in the last few years, there'll be an increase in Social Security. The cost of living increases in Social Security are not included in the calculation of this at all. They just keep on going up. And henceforth, the cost of living increases in workers' comp will not be included in the calculation at all. Once that calculation is determined to be $240, it will remain that way from then on out. Otherwise, if it weren't that way, every time you had a cost of living increase, you wouldn't get an increase at all.
Right.
You'd have a greater reduction on the other side. Is that
That was the intent. Okay. All right. Thank you, Roy, very much. Clayton Patrick.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Clayton Patrick.
Member
of the committee.
Thank you.
And staff. Oh, there's another one.
Oh, another one. Two members.
My name is Clayton Patrick. I'm an attorney. I'm with Jim Marquis and Associates, representing Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm also here on my own behalf, and I want to tell you right out exactly why. I am one of two attorneys who are representing the class of permanent total recipients in this state in a class action against the Workers' Compensation Department, the Workers' Compensation Board, and the state of Oregon as a result of their administration of the 1977 offset provisions. That action is currently pending in Marion County Circuit Court. It has been certified as a class action, and we are proceeding with a case that deals with the subject matter of this particular bill. I'm certainly not speaking against the bill or the concept behind it, except that I wanted you to be certainly aware that the matters that the bill addresses, at least in part, are matters that are addressed in the class action suit in Marion County Circuit Court. I think the bill's been fairly well explained, but getting back to the bill itself, the first problem I have with it is why was the original bill changed? Because when I first saw the original 371, to me it seemed like a very good idea. Not even looking at our particular lawsuit, but just simply looking at what it did. The original bill of 371, and if you don't have copies of it, I have one here. The original bill simply allowed the Workers' Compensation Board to waive recovery of overpayments for any kind of overpayment, any time they determined that an overpayment resulted from administrative delay or Workers' Compensation Department error or federal agency error. This would have given the Workers' Compensation Board a parallel procedure to one that is currently provided in the Social Security Administration, whereby any worker who has been charged with an overpayment may make an individual application, for a waiver of that overpayment if, in fact, the overpayment was not his or her fault. The original 371 would have allowed this to apply to any kind of overpayment, and there are numerous other overpayment situations in the workers' compensation department that the new bill, the Aaron Gross bill, does not address. The most particular one deals with temporary total disability benefits. There are many, many times when a worker is receiving temporary total disability benefits and there is a delay in determining whether or not the case is to be closed and a determination to be made as to whether there should be permanent benefits or not. While that delay is going on, the temporary total disability benefits are continuing, and then suddenly 3 to 5 months later they determine that there is no permanent disability and the worker is terminated from temporary total as of 3 to 5 months prior, and suddenly he or she is faced with an overpayment. That situation happens all the time. And this bill, the original 371, would have allowed a process for dealing with that problem when it's no fault of the worker. And to me, that seems to be a shame that the thing was taken out of there. I know that Mr. Green stated that this Aaron Gross version of Senate Bill 371 deals with the future problems, but I, reading the bill, failed to see anything in there that deals with the future problems. The bill simply provides that the overpayment shall be ordered to be paid by the, or ordered to be refunded by the insurer if there is an authorization prior to the effective date of the act. So even if there is an authorization for an overpayment collection that results from the Social Security offset, if it occurs after the effective date of the act, this bill doesn't do anything for it. I don't know whether that's just a drafting problem or whether that's what they really intended, but that's the way I've read it many times, and that's the way it reads to me. I wanted to speak generally to this whole problem that resulted from the 1977 legislation. I know it's late, I'll try to be brief. There were questions raised by Representative Johnson and also by Representative Rogers. I'm sorry they're not here. Perhaps I should speak with them individually. But, you know, did the worker know about suddenly having an increase in his or her benefits? The whole administration, both of workers' compensation and Social Security, disability benefits, is so fouled up that most of the workers don't know what's going on. And they get increases, they get reductions, and they're a total loss to understand why those increases or reductions occur. And then they get thumped for overpayments, both from Social Security and from workers' compensation. And I've seen overpayment calculations that were 5 pages long, single spaced, and even I couldn't even begin to understand what was going on with those things. You've already been told that Congressman Allman's office has been involved in this. There's currently a moratorium on the Social Security overpayments collections, but you know, we don't know what's going to happen with that. The Social Security overpayment collections are also a part of this lawsuit. I should also point out that there was a similar lawsuit that was not a class action that was brought in Multnomah County on the behalf of 5 workers, in which they alleged, along the lines of the allegations in our particular lawsuit, that the Workers' Compensation Department was not following the law in their application of this offset provision. That particular action resulted in an order enjoining the Workers' Compensation Department from continuing to violate the law with regard to those 5 workers, but it didn't apply any more broadly than that. And that's one reason why the class action suit is proceeding the way it is to try to deal with the entire problem. I'm not trying to use this as a forum to debate the merits of the suit. I just wanted you to be aware of it. The Social Security overpayments that are now being collected, it is alleged in our lawsuit, are being collected partly as a result of unlawful acts performed by the Workers' Compensation Department and the Workers' Compensation Board. That's only an allegation, but that's part of the reason the lawsuit is in existence. the difficulty with the Social Security offsets is that even though, as Mr. Green correctly pointed out, workers gave the information to the Social Security office that they had an increase in workers' compensation benefits, which should have resulted in a decrease in their Social Security payments. Many times that information just didn't make it through to the computer. But as a result of certain, as a result of certain actions that resulted from the 1977 legislation, the Social Security Administration was suddenly collecting overpayments from a majority of the over 1,000 people who were receiving permanent total disability benefits. And one of the reasons they didn't realize that they weren't getting reductions in their workers' compensation benefits when the offset provision went into effect in July 1978 was, in fact, as was pointed out earlier, that the Social Security Administration was reducing their benefits or not raising their benefits because they were trying to collect these overpayments. It's an incredibly complicated area. I'm not even going to try to explain it further to you. I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions or give you any information about the problem. The one reason that I wanted to mention the existence of a lawsuit is not particularly because of what the bill in fact does, because it does in fact only deal with workers' compensation overpayments, not Social Security overpayments, but because of the information that I keep receiving third hand from various people who seem to think that this bill takes care of the entire problem that was raised initially by both offset, and it just doesn't do that. And also, I believe there may also possibly be some constitutional problems if in fact this bill is designed to remedy the problem that is raised in a lawsuit. There may be Oregon constitutional problems with that. It's my understanding that Representative Whalen has requested the Attorney General to give an opinion on that particular subject.
It can join the ranks to get behind several other bills we have in this committee on whether or not they're constitutional.
But let me just close by saying, the basic idea behind the bill I certainly don't have any problem with, and if in fact it's constitutional and proper to deal with this whole problem with legislation rather than lawsuit, then that's fine. I'm only concerned about the workers. I just wanted to bring this to your attention. And also, to wonder, why was the original bill gutted the way it was when it seemed to me to be a perfectly good idea to allow, generally, this whole waiver of overpayment, upon an administrative application by the worker?
We'll find out if we can.
Any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Robert Kennedy.
Mr. Chairman, committee member, Bob Kennedy, Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO supports Senate Bill 371A, or whatever it takes to make the worker, or put the worker in a position where they would not have to pay back these overpayments they have received through no fault of their own. You already have copies of my testimony, and you've had it in your office quite some time ago, and I'm not going to delve into that unless you have some questions. Testimony probably confused you, and I think Mr. Young and Mr. Green have done a good job in explaining it, but mine would just confuse you more. If you are confused.
No.
Now we understand why the worker doesn't understand some of the stuff that you get.
Absolutely.
I know.
Any questions, Bob? Okay, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
I apologize if I trip over this. Mr. Jim?
No.
Francis Coney. Okay.
Chairperson, members of committee. My name is Jim Francis Coney with the law firm of Dobley, Bischoff, and Murray. it's a claimant firm. We represent lots of workers all over the state. I'm from Portland. The reason I'm speaking to you, and I will do it very briefly, is about what Mr. Patrick said. Why was the bill gutted? And I'm speaking in terms of primarily the temporary total disability overpayment, which are not addressed now in the bill that you have before you. I'm not going to talk in the abstract. In fact, the only thing I'm going to talk about is one particular case, one of my cases, where there was, and I provide you with the documents there on Mr. Lauren Reba. He had an overpayment of $23,000, not 5 or 6 months, I believe it's, but we're talking about $21,000, pardon me, $587.63. He was injured on February 11th of 1976. He sustained a neck injury while working at Willamette Industries when he was hit by a jitney. He had been employed for that company for well over 10 years, and he's not worked since. He had, except for a brief period of time. He received the determination order closing his claim finally on, it was mailed on January 11th of 1979. Now, this determination order he received after his claim was submitted for closure by the insurance company on November 30th of 1978. Now, at that time, the board determined he was entitled to temporary total disability only from February 11th, 1976 through September 5th of 1976. And in point of fact, he had been receiving temporary total disability benefits of about $440 all the way until the determination order came out. So then on the third document you have is dated January 29th of 1979, when the insurance company has made demand on him for the total amount of $21,000. They indicate to him that they have not paid him his permanent partial disability award of 20% on his neck, and that therefore he has $19,036.51 that he owes him. And they also say that you're to pay it at once, or to make arrangements within 30 days from the date of this letter. I wish that Mr. Johnson was here too, because Mr. Reba was totally aware that he had to pay back any of this sum, and it came as a total shock to him when he received, well, first of all, it came as a shock to him when he was only received a 20% award on his neck. Then when he received this letter dated January 29th, 1979, he really went into shock. In fact, under doctor's orders, he is now in Arizona trying to recover. He has no income. Again, as I said, he's only worked briefly since that original injury. Now, talking about addressing the issue of his fault in this matter, according to the insurance company's instructions, he saw all the doctors, kept all of his doctor reports. The insurance company and the employer had regular access to all these medical reports. You know, and their payments kept coming. They kept coming, and they kept coming. See, no fault of his own did he in any way contribute. Now he's age 62 and he's unemployed. He doesn't know quite what to do. Now, again, this matter is in litigation. We're contesting the extent of his TTD entitlement. But there's no way of knowing which way that's going to go. And it's very possible that he's going to have to pay that back. I'm not sure how. They'll never collect it. But it's a valid debt, as indicated in this letter. Just as any valid debt, they can take whatever steps they want to repay it, whatever legal steps. Now, I have not been practicing myself that long, but I'm practicing a firm, in fact, a very long time. This is the worst example that our particular firm has seen. But $5,000 and $6,000 overpayments, through no fault of the workers, are common occurrences. Now this is four times that, and it's just our feeling, the workers' feeling. It's certainly claimants' attorneys have nothing. We're not getting part of that overpayment. I mean, we have no financial interest. but it's just a feeling that you feel that the workers are genuinely being screwed for no reasons of their own.
Really, he jumps out at you, doesn't it? Okay, well, we're going to find an answer to the last question there. I think we may have somebody else that's going to testify that speaks through it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Marty?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Monty King. I'm the legislative assistant for Representative Grinnell and Representative Stevenson, Mr. Chairman and member of the committee. The original Senate Bill 371 was drafted by Jim Reddy Jr. of President Bo's office, and I assisted in the redrafting of the measure. The measure was originally introduced by the committee at the request of, Representative Grinnell and President Bo and some other members for the express purpose of dealing with the overpayments as are outlined in 371. The language in the original 371 were too broad. It would be Representative Grinnell's position that if somebody else would like to deal with the rest of the overpayment problem of the workers' compensation system and the Oregon insurers, that they should do that in a separate vehicle.
I can understand why.
Right. I've got a copy of a petition that was put out that was organized down on the South Coast. It's got quite a number of pages on it dealing with the workers' compensation, Social Security offset program, and the problems that have been associated with it over the last almost a year. This is what we're addressing, we're trying to address with the bill, not the rest of the problem. And it by no means detracts from the rest of the problem. I don't mean to do that at all.
What you're saying is you don't want to tag on the rest of it and lose the bill, potentially.
Right. There has been legislation introduced in the Congress by Congressman Weaver,
right,
to deal with the offset problem and to take away the power of the offset of the state.
Monty, for your information, and pass it on to your boss. I was back there a few weeks ago when I talked to Jim on that legislation and also on what he was working on too. So my office. And keeping him informed, I'm sure.
Willing to testify, I'll say to the other gentleman here that we're talking about the temporary total disability. We will. I think we got an answer as to why it's not in this bill. Possibly, I'll explore it further with the committee, and then maybe we can take a look at it in another vehicle. That's not good. That's all. Okay, that's it. We thank you very much. Close to him.